We've been talking a lot lately about how we can all make a difference right where we live. And you've sent in some really interesting stuff about that very thing for Deer Park, LaPorte, and Pasadena, Texas, which is, what we're all about here on the Deep Dive.
Absolutely.
Much like our friends over at the Think and Act Locally podcast.
Yeah.
So today we're diving into this audio recording all about housing,
Yeah, housing.
which is, so important for strong communities. And we want to see if we can pull out some actionable insights from this thing.
Yeah, for sure. One of the things that really stood out to me right off the bat was what the speaker had to say about how local housing initiatives are financed.
Okay.
You're listening, you're probably thinking about how to make things happen where you live and how to get projects funded.
Yep.
So the speaker, Chuck Moron, he kind of lays out this initial assessment that's a little bit surprising. He says that very few cities have actually found a successful model.
But then he goes on to talk about this example he thinks is brilliant,
Right.
Muskegon, Michigan,
Yeah, Muskegon.
and their use of TIF tax increment financing.
Yes. TIF, this is
It's like
important.
this TIF idea is key here.
Yeah, it really is. Because the core problem that he brings up is that the way things work now, a lot of times local governments, they can end up losing money.
Losing money.
Yeah, on these housing initiatives. It happens through different incentives that they offer to developers, or they end up paying for new infrastructure, and then the increase in housing supply, it doesn't keep up with the demand.
Oh,
So
wow.
he's arguing that this approach is just not sustainable. You want to see real impact where you live,
Yeah.
and this is a huge problem.
Right. And I bet a lot of people listening are thinking, well, what about the feds? Can't they just step in and help with the money?
Yeah, that's a natural question, but the source material kind of pushes back on that pretty hard.
Oh, really?
Yeah, the speaker flat out says no. And his reasoning is really important to understanding how to approach this from a local angle. He says that local governments and the federal government, they function really differently.
Okay.
And maybe even more importantly, they have different motivations.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And he cautions against this mistake that we often make, which is thinking that local government is just like a smaller version of the federal government.
Right. Different scales, different responsibilities.
Exactly.
Yeah.
At the local level, being financially sound is so crucial. He makes this comparison that I think a lot of people can relate to. He says a city budget, it's like a family budget. You've got money coming in, money going out. You got to make sure it balances.
Right,
You
yeah.
can't just print more money. You can't run these huge deficits forever.
Right.
So relying on the feds to solve these local financing problems, it really goes against the whole idea of finding solutions that are driven by the community.
I see. So no federal help. All right, so let's dig into this tax increment financing, this TIF that the speaker keeps coming back to. What is it exactly?
So basically, TIF, it works on the idea that when you have new development, property values go up.
Okay, makes sense.
And when property values go up, you get more revenue from property taxes.
Right.
And that extra revenue, that's the increment. It's the difference between what you were collecting before the development and what you're collecting after.
Gotcha.
And what TIF does is it lets a city capture that new tax revenue and use it specifically to pay for the project or the improvements that made the value go up in the first place.
Okay, so the growth helps pay for the growth.
Exactly. Can you do me an example?
Yeah, can you illustrate that with some simple numbers, like the speaker did?
Absolutely. So imagine you have an empty piece of land. It's not generating much property tax revenue, maybe none at all.
Okay.
Now, let's say someone builds a house on that land. The value goes way up.
Right.
Let's say, for simplicity's sake, that the local property tax rate is 2%.
Okay.
Before the house, the tax revenue was practically nothing.
Right.
But after the house, let's say the house is assessed at $100,000.
Or
The
not.
annual property tax would be $2,000.
Okay.
That $2,000, that's the tax increment.
Gotcha.
So through a TIF district, the city could take that $2,000 every year for a certain amount of time and use it to finance things related to that development or other developments in the district.
Okay, so I'm starting to see how this could work. How did Muskegon use this TIF idea to deal with their housing needs, especially for those entry-level homes they were trying to encourage?
What's really interesting about Muskegon is how targeted they were.
Okay.
They weren't using TIF for just any development. They were focused on infill lots.
Infill lots.
Yeah, those vacant or underused pieces of land that are already in existing neighborhoods. They already have the infrastructure,
Yeah.
water lines, sewer systems, roads, all that stuff.
I see.
And they were specifically trying to incentivize the building of starter homes,
Yeah.
smaller houses, maybe 600 to 900 square feet.
Okay.
And the key here is they use that future tax increment that they're expecting to provide down payment assistance.
Down payment assistance.
Yeah, for those entry-level homes.
So where does that money for the down payment assistance come from in the first place?
So the city basically borrows money by issuing bonds.
Bonds.
It's like the city taking out a loan from investors.
Okay.
To use our example from before, they might borrow $20,000 to put towards the down payment on that $100,000 house.
Right.
So now the buyer only needs $80,000 up front.
Okay.
And then over time, let's say 10 years, the city collects that $2,000 annual tax increment.
From the property.
Right. And they use that to pay back the bond.
Oh, that's interesting.
The speaker mentioned that he was simplifying things a little bit by leaving out interest, but that's the basic idea.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. It's really using future growth to take care of current needs.
Exactly.
And what happens once that loan is paid off?
Once the loan is paid off, that whole $2,000 in annual property taxes, it goes back to the city's general funds.
Okay.
Just like any other property tax revenue. The speaker made two points that are really important here.
Okay.
First, the city isn't actually losing money with this model. The increased tax revenue covers the initial investment.
Right.
Which means they could potentially do this over and over again.
Right.
Second, they have these things called clawback provisions.
Clawback provisions.
Yeah. It's a way to prevent speculation.
Yeah.
So if someone buys one of these homes with the down payment help, and then they turn around and sell it quickly.
Okay.
They have to pay back some or all of the assistance they got.
Oh, that's a good idea.
Yeah. The longer they stay in the home, the more of that benefit they keep.
That makes sense. It keeps people from just flipping the properties.
Yeah.
And it makes sure the help goes to people who want to actually live in the community.
Right.
Now, there were some other questions about TIFs in the recording. Someone asked about the city's part in all this and who actually owns the land.
Right. So the speaker said that in Muskegon, the city doesn't actually own the land. Instead, they put a tax lien on the property.
A tax lien?
It's like a legal claim on the property. It guarantees that if the property is sold too soon, the city can get back the down payment assistance they provided.
Right, through those clawback provisions.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So it reinforces the idea that the city's role is really about helping with the financing, not becoming a landlord.
Okay, that makes sense. And that leads us back to this question that came up a bunch of times in the recording.
Yeah.
What about the federal government? Could they help cities pay for these TIF initiatives? The speaker seemed pretty clear on his answer to that one.
Oh, yeah. He was really against relying on federal help for this kind of local financing.
Mm.
He pointed out that cities already have the power to borrow a lot of money by issuing bonds.
Oh.
But the problem, he says, is that a lot of times that money is used for projects that don't make money.
Right.
And sometimes those projects can even create more financial problems for the city down the road.
Yeah, that's a problem.
So he argues that cities should be using that borrowing power for things like TIF-funded housing, where the increase in tax revenue directly pays off the debt.
Mm.
This approach, it doesn't hurt the city's finances.
Mm.
Instead, it uses the tools they already have to create more housing in a sustainable way.
I see. And that really reinforces this idea that for communities like Deer Park, La Porte, and Pasadena, good solutions that are driven by the community are possible.
Absolutely.
Okay, so we've talked a lot about local financing using TIFs. Now let's shift gears and talk about the big one, housing affordability. It seems like a lot of people think that you absolutely need subsidies to make housing affordable.
Right. And the speaker in the recording, he kind of questions the way we usually think about that.
Oh, really?
Yeah. He agrees that cost is related to supply and demand.
Right.
But he says that the biggest factors that affect housing prices, they're happening at a national level.
National.
Yeah. It's all tied into these complicated things like mortgage-backed securities and other financial stuff.
Right.
It's not just about how many houses are for sale in a specific area versus how many people want to buy them.
So just building more market-rate housing locally, that might not solve the affordability problem on its own.
That's what he seems to be saying.
Mm.
Because of this big interconnected national financial market for housing local areas, they can't really control overall housing prices just by building more houses.
Okay, so what's the solution?
So that's why he really emphasizes this idea of focusing on the entry-level housing market.
Entry-level housing.
Yeah.
And why is the entry-level market different?
So entry-level homes, they're less likely to be affected by that national secondary mortgage market and all the price swings that come with it.
Okay.
So if you can establish local financing, like that Muskegon-style TIF specifically for starter homes.
Right.
And if you can address things like zoning, your regulations that make it hard to build on a smaller scale.
Okay.
You can create a more stable housing market that's controlled locally.
I see.
And that gives your community a real shot at making housing more affordable for its residents.
Now, one thing that people might worry about is if we take this kind of gradual, incremental approach, how can we keep up with the demand? Especially if it's really high locally. The recording talked about this too.
Yes, and the speaker made a really important point. He said, incremental doesn't mean slow.
Ah, okay.
He's pushing back on this idea that incremental development means things move at a snail's pace.
Right.
He contrasts these big subdivision projects that can take forever to finish.
Right.
With the potential to create housing much faster through what he calls thickening up existing neighborhoods.
Thickening up?
Yeah, things like adding ADUs, accessory dwelling units, sometimes called backyard cottages, or developing those smaller infill lots that we talked about before, all within existing neighborhoods.
Gotcha. So instead of waiting years for one huge project to be finished, you could have a bunch of smaller projects happening all over the city at the same time.
Exactly. And he gave this great example. He said, a new subdivision with 40 homes, that might seem like a big deal.
Yeah.
But if you add just one or two smaller units to each block across the whole city, that could actually create hundreds or even thousands of new homes pretty quickly.
Wow.
And you're not disrupting the character of the existing neighborhoods as much.
Interesting. So it really changes how we think about how quickly we can increase the housing supply.
Exactly.
Which brings us back to this idea that's really common, that you can't build affordable housing without subsidies. The speaker had some pretty strong opinions about that.
Yeah, he really challenged that idea.
Huh.
He said that relying so much on subsidies, it often leads to cities spending tons of money to create a small number of affordable units.
Okay.
But the bigger problem of overall housing affordability, it doesn't really get solved.
Right.
He made this distinction between making affordable housing.
Making affordable housing.
Which is basically subsidizing those high-cost development models that already exist.
Right.
And making housing affordable.
Making housing affordable.
Which means changing the whole system of how we build housing and making it cheaper.
So he's saying that just throwing money at subsidies, that's not a long-term solution.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And he thinks we should rethink, maybe even eliminate subsidies for those big market rate housing developments.
Oh, wow.
He says those kinds of projects, they already have access to all this national financing.
Okay.
Instead, he says we should focus on building up that strong entry-level housing market that we talked about.
Right.
He says that will create more competition, which will bring prices down, and it will give people a better chance at owning a home.
Right.
And he connects this to the idea that cities need to be careful about expanding outward and paying for all that infrastructure for new developments.
Yeah, that's a big issue, especially in places like Deer Park, LaPorte, and Pasadena.
Absolutely.
Now, the recording also brought up this question about different types of housing in a neighborhood.
Right.
And whether that makes for stronger communities. What were the main takeaways there?
The speaker agreed that having different housing types can be good for neighborhoods.
Okay.
But he said that what really matters is price point and income diversity.
Price point and income diversity.
Yeah. Not just having different styles of buildings or different types of housing.
Okay.
And then he said something he called the uncomfortable truth.
The uncomfortable truth.
He said that a lot of times when people resist having a variety of housing options, it's because they want to keep people with lower incomes out.
Oh, wow.
That's a pretty direct statement.
Yeah. Can you explain that a little more?
He said that the way we've developed things since World War II and the zoning rules we've put in place,
right,
they've created neighborhoods that are separated by how much the housing costs.
Okay.
And he says that people might say they're worried about the character of the neighborhood or parking.
Yeah.
But what they really don't want is to share public spaces and resources with people who don't make as much money.
That's interesting.
And then he made this point that was kind of surprising but important. He said that sometimes the poorest neighborhoods, they can actually bring in the most tax revenue compared to how much it costs the city to provide services there. And he concluded that real income diversity, which you get when you have more housing options at different prices,
right,
that makes for healthier and more resilient communities.
That's really thought-provoking. It definitely challenges some of the common ideas about what makes a good neighborhood and the impact of different types of housing.
Yeah.
Okay, last big topic in the affordability discussion was this really interesting analogy to student loans.
Yes. The speaker compared government-backed student loans to the rising cost of college.
Okay.
And he asked if the same thing might be happening in the housing market.
Interesting. And what did he say?
He agreed that it is.
It is?
Yeah.
Yeah.
He said that putting more money into the housing system through subsidies and easy financing,
okay,
it often makes prices go up.
Instead of making things more efficient or more affordable.
Exactly. It's like that demand is artificially inflated.
I see.
And that lets people pay more.
Okay.
Which means builders and suppliers, they don't have to find better ways to build or lower their prices.
Right, because they can still sell their stuff.
Exactly. He even told this story about a real estate finance professor who said we should put more money into the market to make things more efficient.
Okay.
But the speaker,
yeah,
he argued that housing, it's not like electronics.
Not like buying a new TV or something.
Right. It's more like education or healthcare.
Okay.
When you put more money in, prices usually go up.
So the very programs that are supposed to help people get housing might actually be contributing to the problem in the long run?
That's the argument.
Wow.
By subsidizing demand and making it easy to get financing,
okay,
we're basically letting prices go up.
Which then stifles real innovation and cost reduction.
Right.
Okay, that's a really important point to understand.
Yeah.
The last part of the recording talked about how to get more citizen-driven development going. What was the main idea there?
The speaker said that when we think about citizen-driven development, we shouldn't picture these big projects that are led by developers where citizens just give a little input.
Okay.
He wants to see a shift towards what he calls the thickening up of every neighborhood.
The thickening up?
Yeah, through incremental development, adding smaller units like backyard cottages or building on those smaller infill lots.
Right, like we talked about.
All spread out in existing neighborhoods.
Okay.
He thinks that's the real citizen-led growth.
So it's not about these huge master planned communities with a few citizens on an advisory board.
Yeah.
It's about giving individual homeowners or small local builders the power to create housing in established neighborhoods.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And he said that the rules and regulations and the way financing works now,
okay,
they all favor these big developers.
Who are often from out of town.
Right. They have access to more money and they know how to deal with these huge complicated projects.
Right.
So it's not a level playing field for the smaller local people who might want to build a duplex or a few houses on an empty lot.
So how can a community fix that? How can they level the playing field and encourage this more citizen-driven approach?
So the speaker gave a few key recommendations.
Right.
First, reform those zoning and land use rules to make it easier to build smaller scale housing and entry level housing.
Right.
Second, support those smaller local developers.
Okay.
Give them the help they need. And third, use those local financing tools strategically.
Like the Muskegon style TIF.
Right. Support that part of the market without putting the city in a bad financial position.
Right.
He also mentioned this toolkit from Strongtowns called Housing Ready Cities.
Housing Ready Cities.
Yeah, you can find it at strongtowns.org/housing-ready.
We'll put a link in the show notes.
Great. It's a good resource for communities that want to change their rules.
Right.
And his overall message was all about communities taking action and being self-reliant. Don't wait for the feds or the state to come in and fix things.
So for you listening in Deer Park, LaPorte, and Pasadena,
yeah,
the main takeaway seemed to be that waiting for the federal government to solve local housing problems, that's not really a solution. Local financing like TIFs can be really powerful, like they showed in Muskegon. We need to focus on making it easier to build entry-level housing through incremental development and smart changes to regulations. And we need to rethink those approaches that rely heavily on subsidies.
Absolutely. And think about how these ideas could work in your community.
Yeah.
Look into the local rules about infill development and building smaller housing.
Maybe the Think and Act Locally podcast.
Yeah.
Could be a good place to discuss these things and figure out how to take action.
Definitely.
And it's worth thinking about how having more diverse housing options and a wider range of income levels in your neighborhoods.
Yeah.
That could make your community stronger in the long run.
Absolutely.
And on that note, here's a final thought for you as you go about your week in Deer Park, LaPorte, or Pasadena.
Yeah.
What if we shifted our focus away from chasing these big projects that often need subsidies?
Right.
And instead, we focused on making it easier to do a lot of smaller, locally financed projects. How would that change how resilient and affordable housing is in your community?
That's a great question.